I have tremendous respect and appreciation for Lula's abilities as a politician, but I'm not sure he's ever dealt with a challenge quite like this one before. And if he does really truly believe that he can come into office and do things more or less as he did the first time around, he might be in for a big surprise.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Lauren Zhao. On October 2nd, Brazil held its general elections, leading to a runoff between candidates Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and Jair Bolsonaro, scheduled for October 30th. Brian Winter joins me today to discuss the two candidates, their individual approaches to their campaign, and how the election results reflect shifting trends in Latin America and other regions. Brian Winter is the editor-in-chief of the publication America's Quarterly and has been one of the most influential analysts on Latin American issues. He's also the vice president of policy for the Americas Society and Councils of the Americas. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So on October 2nd, 2022, general elections in Brazil were held between six candidates, including Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and Jair Bolsonaro. Lula won 48.4% of votes, while Bolsonaro won 43.2% in the first round of the election, pushing them to runoffs. What has been the initial public response to these first round results?
I think the first reaction a lot of Brazilians felt was surprise, because the result that we saw on October 2nd was so different from what many of the polls had shown. Many of the biggest polls in Brazil had shown that Lula would win by a margin of 12, 14, or even 16 percentage points and might even get the 50% of total votes necessary in order to win the election in the first round. That was not the case. What we ended up with instead was this 5 percentage point margin. And it was a good day for Brazilian conservatives all along. Many of Bolsonaro's allies and former ministers were elected to positions in Brazil's Senate. They also are in position to become governors of several important states, including Sao Paulo, the country's biggest state, where you've got about a quarter of the population. So overall, as we head into this runoff, which is now taking place on October 30th, there's a view that Lula is still probably the favorite, but it's going to be close. And no one at this point, or very few people at least, are willing to completely count out Bolsonaro.
Great. So I guess, what are kind of these platforms that Lula and Bolsonaro are running on, and what parties do they represent?
Well, you have Lula representing the left, but more than anything, he's representing a return, or at least an attempt to return to the Brazil of the 2000s. The Brazil of the 2000s was really the last time that the economy performed very well, and it was a good decade for Brazil. It was a decade when you saw as many as 35 million people come out of poverty and into the middle class. These were also the years when Brazil was awarded the ability to host the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. That was taken at the time as kind of a confirmation that Brazil's moment on the world stage had finally arrived. These were the years when I was living in Brazil, at the tail end, at least. I visited Brazil a lot in the late 2000s and then lived there from 2010 to 2015. So I caught the very tail end of the Lula years. And this was a year when, or this was a period when Brazil was very confident on the world stage. And seemingly the sky was the limit. In fact, people were saying that there was a chance that living standards in Brazil might converge with those of Portugal or Spain by the end of the 2010s. That was not the case. Brazil had a really rough decade after Lula left. As a matter of fact, still today, Brazil, the average Brazilian is 10% poorer than they were back in 2013. It's been a long period of difficulties for Brazil. So what Lula is essentially saying in this election, more than any specific platform, is I have the ability to take us back to that golden era. Beyond that, he hasn't offered a whole lot of specifics. And then you asked about Bolsonaro. Well, I think he represents a certain continuity of his last 4 years. which is a period where he has put together a coalition that includes evangelical Christians, who are an increasingly important part of Brazilian society, as well as members of agribusiness, small business owners generally, the wealthy, and some others. But he really, you know, these have been a difficult 4 years for Brazil. It's 4 years during which, of course, we had the pandemic, and everybody suffered from that, particularly in Latin America. But in Brazil, we've had more than 680,000 people die. That's the second highest total globally, behind only the United States. And President Bolsonaro has received a lot of criticism for his handling of the pandemic, not only for being later than Brazil could have been in terms of vaccination, but also with regard to how he spoke about the pandemic, embracing some of the quote-unquote cures like hydroxychloroquine, but also, you know, telling the country at one point, and this is just one quote that he said, that Brazil needed to stop being a country of sissies. That was his words, of course, and get on with daily life. So, you know, these are two figures that arouse quite a lot of passion among their base, but a lot of disgust amongst their opponents. And it's a very polarized country as we head into this October 30th vote.
Yeah. And kind of moving a little bit back towards Bolsonaro's presidency over the past 4 years, I guess, could you tell us a little bit like more specifics about the issues at the forefront of his presidency and how he handled them? And were his policies popular with the general population?
Well, I think to really understand Bolsonaro, you have to go back to 2018, which was the year he was elected. And that was a year where Brazil was coming out of the worst part of this recession, this decade-long stagnant period that it's been in. Public anger was very high. Bolsonaro was replacing a president, Michel Temer, who did not run in 2018. He was not a candidate, in part because his approval rating was only 3%, which is kind of amazing to consider. And Brazil was also struggling with a record high in homicides and still dealing with the aftermath of a huge corruption scandal known as Lava Jato that had put the entire political establishment, kind of left, center, and right, in disgrace. And that public anger and the desire of a lot of Brazilians to throw out pretty much everybody who was in office was how we ended up with Jair Bolsonaro. He came in with, you know, some specific policy ideas. He had a finance minister, Paulo Guedes, who's still in office, still in his cabinet, who was promising to reduce the size of the Brazilian state and make essentially the private sector more prominent. Bolsonaro also had, you know, some ideas about how to crack down on this rise in homicides. He had always advocated kind of a shoot first, ask questions later approach from the police. One famous quote that he said during that campaign was, "A policeman who doesn't kill is not a policeman." And he also believed and said, and was pretty consistent in this, that he thought the Amazon was underexploited from an economic perspective and that it needed to be opened up to more development, including mining. And so here we are 4 years later, and Amazon deforestation has gone way up. The economy, they've made some reforms, but not many, in part because Bolsonaro has had his attention in so many other areas. Bolsonaro's greatest passion is kind of Brazil's version of the culture wars, which are not that different looking than the culture wars that we see in the United States. Lots of talk about quote unquote gender ideology, abortion, the LGBTQ community, and others. Bolsonaro and his base would seemingly much rather focus on that than the economy. So the economic results, partly for that reason, have not been that good. Of course, the pandemic played another major role in that. And then as far as crime, homicides have come down in Brazil, although the reasons behind that are complex, and analysts sort of argue over whether or how much credit Bolsonaro deserves as a result. But that's the way these things work sometimes, is, you know, it's not always the president's fault or credit, but however things go while they're in office, they, you know, it's kind of becomes part of their record. But what's interesting to me is sitting here in 2022, there was this, you know, belief that maybe the anger of 2018 was the only reason for Bolsonaro's rise, and that now in this election, voters would kind of look for something else. That really isn't what's happened. Time and again in this election on October 2nd, that happened a few weeks ago, Brazilian voters voted for the most conservative, most Bolsonarista candidate, whether it was for Congress or for governor. And so I think it's safe to say that this conservative movement that he started is going to be around for a long time.
And how has this, I mean, his conservative movement and his record as president been a major factor in this year's election cycle? Who are his major supporters? And are they different from the previous election?
I think the coalition that Bolsonaro is more or less the same as in 2018, although it is smaller. You know, he has lost a lot of support because of the disgust that people feel over his handling of the pandemic and the fact that the economy is really not appreciably better than when he took office in 2019. The economy's gotten a little better these last couple months. Inflation right now is actually lower than that of the United States at about 7%. We're at about 8% here in the U.S. But things are still tough out there, including there was a recent estimate that 33 million Brazilians out of a population of more than 210 million suffer some degree of either hunger or food insecurity. When I was in Brazil 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in Rio and Sao Paulo, the two biggest cities, and I can tell you that, you know, the amount of homeless people that you see there on the streets is much higher, significantly higher than it has been at any other time I can remember in these 20 years that I've been traveling to and writing about Brazil. But, you know, I always like to say that campaigns and elections in particular, they're not a yes-no. They're an either-or. And so even though a lot of people have doubts or even are still angry at Bolsonaro over his handling of the pandemic, that doesn't necessarily mean they want to vote for Lula. And so Bolsonaro's coalition includes a lot of people who just think that, you know, the Workers' Party, the PT, as it's known by its initials in Portuguese, was to blame for Brazil's long crisis. And they still think that Bolsonaro has a chance to fix things. It's also true that Brazilian society is changing right before our eyes, in part because of the growth of the evangelical Christian community, which has gone from being about 10% of Brazil's population back in the 1980s to an estimated one-third today. And that's part of the reason why these issues that Bolsonaro talks about, the social issues, the kind of culture war issues, continue to motivate such a significant part of his base.
Yeah, and I guess moving on to Bolsonaro's opposing candidate, Lula, we've kind of talked about Brazil's economic boom and financial discipline during his presidential term, and he's kind of promised the same or a slightly newer approach to the country's issues. I guess, what are his campaign policies and who are his main supporters, and how do his current policies differ from his in the 2000s?
Well, neither Lula nor Bolsonaro have published detailed platforms about what they would do if elected. And so, and in the case of Lula, he has literally told interviewers, I don't need to talk about, and I'm paraphrasing here, but not by much. He said, I don't need to talk about the future. All you need to do is look at what I did in the past. So that, you know, that requires a bit of a leap of faith from voters, but it's a leap that many are willing to take because his record was so good the first time around. But then you start getting into philosophical questions about why Lula did succeed when he was president from 2003 to 2010. that was an era when Brazil, as well as the other big economies in South America, pretty much everybody did well because it was a period of exceptional demand from China for the commodities that South America produces. I'm talking about not only oil, but iron ore and soy, copper, and some other things. And so by a regional standard, a South American standard, Brazil's performance during those years was not exceptional. In fact, it was pretty much in line with what other countries were doing. And it all raises the question, how will things go if Lula is elected again, but without that commodities boom? And nobody has the answer to that question. Nobody knows whether the kind of recipes and philosophies that he espoused the first time around will succeed in a world that is much more adverse, like the one that we have today with the war in Ukraine putting pressure on inflation globally. China is not having such a great period right now in terms of consumer demand, which means that their appetite for Brazilian commodities is not what it was 20 years ago. So I think there's more question marks than answers when it comes to how Lula would run the country if he's, and specifically the economy, if he's elected again.
I guess speaking of more question marks than answers, if Lula does win in the runoff, building off of that, many people are worried about his ability to follow up on his policy promises, as a lot of the right-wing parties have performed very well in the elections for the National Congress. I guess, to what extent do you see this being an issue and an obstacle to Lula's ambitions?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And it's a question that I have too, which is, how will Lula govern? How will Lula govern in a world where he has so much of Congress against him? This is a significantly more right-wing Congress than he governed with the first time around, and even than the one that we had these last couple of years. Bolsonaro's party, even if Bolsonaro loses, Bolsonaro's party will have the biggest block of legislators in both houses of Congress. And society as a whole is just changed. It's just this spiritual awakening of sorts that Brazil has seen these last couple of years really is making its way into politics. And so, you know, one thing that people don't always realize about Brazil from outside the country is that power is diffuse. It's a huge country, right? I mean, it's bigger than the continental United States. And you have all kinds of different parties and regional political bosses and multiple institutions that all hold a bit of power. It is not a all-powerful presidency like you see in some other countries, nor is all the population or half the population in one city, as you see in cases like Argentina and even Chile. So, you know, power is always difficult to wield in Brazil. And I think that, you know, Lula, on the one hand, he's widely considered the most talented politician of his generation. This is someone who has been center stage in Brazilian politics for at least 35 years now. Somebody who ran for president three times before he was finally elected in 2002. And then, you know, was considered by almost everyone in Brazil when he left to have been a raging success with an approval rating between 85 and 90%. This is all to say, I have tremendous respect and appreciation for Lula's abilities as a politician, but I'm not sure he's ever dealt with a challenge quite like this one before. And if he does really truly believe that he can come into office and do things more or less as he did the first time around, he might be in for a big surprise.
Speaking of more challenges and kind of moving towards the realm of foreign policy, we've kind of seen Bolsonaro embracing anti-globalist rhetoric and threatening to withdraw Brazil from the World Health Organization and the Paris Agreement. He's also aligned with many right-wing leaders, such as former U.S. President Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And Lula, on the other hand, had sought close relations with China, Cuba, and Iran during his presidency. How does Lula's foreign policy approach differ from Bolsonaro's, and how will it differ given newer context in this election compared to his presidency?
Well, let's talk about Bolsonaro's foreign policy first. So Bolsonaro allied himself most closely with Donald Trump and has even been called by some the Trump of the tropics, which there's been some controversy over that analogy with people saying it kind of sells short the complications of Brazil and how it's different from the United States. And I understand that point of view, but as an American who studies Brazil, there are so many similarities. I mean, you've got here two men with multiple divorces overseeing movements, conservative movements, where evangelical Christians play a major role. And that's just, you know, that's just the beginning. And Bolsonaro has openly followed Trump's example. In fact, one time Bolsonaro even did a Facebook Live where all it consisted of was him turning on the television. And then we got to watch Bolsonaro silently watch Trump for like 45 minutes. It was unbelievable. And so Bolsonaro has really allied himself with that particular strain or brand of right-wing philosophy, anti-globalist, at least at some level, big emphasis on God and family and other things that also tend to animate many conservatives in the United States. In terms of foreign policy, that has left Bolsonaro quite isolated under the current circumstances. Now that Trump is gone, he was also very close with Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel, who, of course, is also left. At one point, it really looked like Bolsonaro's main ally left in the world was Viktor Orban in Hungary. But now with, you know, the election of a similar right-wing movement in Italy and Sweden, I think this is a movement that we see in other parts of the world that, suffice to say, I think Brazil is not alone. But in South America, it has been very isolated. Bolsonaro has constantly either picked fights with or shown his disdain for the left. In fact, you could really say that Bolsonaro's career in many ways is built off of his hatred for socialism and communism. And now, of course, in South America, we have a region that is almost entirely gone left over the last couple of years, what some call a new pink tide. So many of those relationships between Brazil and, say, Argentina or Chile have become quite cool, if not cold, with Colombia as well. If Lula was to be elected, I think those relationships would clearly improve. There's a lot of difference. There's a lot of nuance in the Latin American left. There's huge difference between, say, Gabriel Boric of Chile, who is young and firmly a Democrat with a lowercase d, and Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, who is a dictator. They're both of the left, but they're very different. I would say that Lula would be able to speak to both sides of that kind of that leftist divide. And you'd have a South America of leaders who would be more or less aligned in terms of their worldview, at least in a lot of important ways. Lula would also pursue a foreign policy that would be perhaps a bit closer to China than Brazil is today. Although I don't want to overestimate that. There's a view that says that kind of treats it as a black and white issue, as if Bolsonaro was pro-US and Lula was pro-China. And the truth is that there's been nuance with both. Bolsonaro was not nearly as anti-China as president, or I should say has not been nearly as anti-China as some expected him to be once in office. I mean, he's played ball with Beijing, most specifically on issues like 5G and the role of Huawei. And I think that by the same token, Lula and some people in the Workers' Party have told me that he will take great care and energy in pursuing a constructive relationship with the United States if he's elected. So, you know, some important details, differences there, but these leaders are not perhaps quite as different in the foreign policy realm, particularly on the China question, as a lot of the debate would have it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess kind of also moving forward a little bit, Bolsonaro has stated that he only sees three possible futures: prison, being killed, or victory, arguing that there may be some possible fraud within the electronic voting system if he loses. And we've kind of seen this trend kind of attacking the validity of voting systems around the world with Trump and Kenyan presidential candidate Raila Odinga. Will there be doubts cast on the legitimacy of this election? And will this dispute affect Brazil's democracy and democratic processes all throughout Latin America?
Well, this is everybody's fear. And I've written about this a lot and talked about it a lot. And I think there is a big risk that if Bolsonaro loses, he will try to reverse the result, in part because of this quote that you said, where he said that he only sees three possible futures: prison, being killed, or victory. He continues to believe as if that's what he really thinks. And if you're desperate, that makes you willing to do pretty much anything. But a lot will depend on how big the margin is on election day. If Lula wins by a solid margin, say more than 4 or 5 percentage points, then I think it becomes very hard for Bolsonaro to do anything about the result. I still expect him to say that there was fraud and to somehow portray Lula's election as illegitimate almost no matter what. But the real concern here is that there would be something resembling a Brazilian version of January 6th, referring, of course, to the insurrection at the Capitol here in the United States. Or worse, because Bolsonaro does have, unlike Trump, the support of some senior figures in the armed forces. In a country like Brazil, that can make a difference. But, you know, like I said earlier, Brazil is a country where power is very diffuse. And I think it will be hard for Bolsonaro, no matter what, to get the kind of support that he would need in order to actually effectively overturn the election result should he lose. And so, you know, a lot of people, some analysts have said, all the commentary around this is kind of hysterical. And we all know that Brazil's institutions are strong and therefore there's just not that much risk. And I disagree, partly as an American who has watched events unfold here in the United States over the last 2 years or so. It's true that our institutions held here in the United States, but the damage from what was done at the end of 2020 here in the beginning of 2021 was and is tremendous. You know, here we are in 2022 and we still have a significant percentage of people in this country who believe that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president. And in a country like Brazil, these things could get very unpredictable very quickly. So, yeah, I worry. And of course, there's also the possibility, as I said, that Bolsonaro could still win. But if we end up with something in between, a close result where Lula is victorious, but maybe only by a percentage point or two, then I think things could be very difficult and Brazil's institutions will really be put to the test.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian, for this informative conversation. And I guess we'll be looking forward to the results on October 30th.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.